You are listening to Sustain Now. In this podcast, you will learn from successful entrepreneurs and scientists about the newest climate change solutions to address the climate crisis. From food and agritech, over energy, material innovation, to circular economy. This nonprofit podcast is hosted by Frederica. She is a tech entrepreneur and climate enthusiast. You can find show notes and background information on www.sustainnow.ch. Enjoy the show.
In today's episode, I'm speaking with Tim Schumacher. Tim is a German investor and entrepreneur with a long-term focus on impact and climate. He co-founded and led the publicly traded Acedo.com, a CEO for 10 years. Since 2012, he has founded and invested in multiple startups like IEO, makers of AppBlock Plus, SAS Group, Solar, Carbon Cloud, Pajama, and Ecosia. Tim Schumacher also very recently co-founded the World Fund, which is a 350 million euro VC fund focusing on climate startups who have the potential to save 100 million CO2. In this episode, you will learn about Tim's journey from an entrepreneur to an investor, climate activism as a teenager, and as well as his top three bets in the climate tech sector. I really enjoyed this episode. I hope you too. Thank you so much for joining my podcast Sustain Now today. Very excited to have you on my podcast because you actually can tell the story of both sides, the founder and the investor story.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
You have successfully founded and built up several software as a services businesses like a domain trading platform, Acedo, an ad blocking company, and later you acted as an investor in many other companies. I listed like so many, you need to help me, like software as a service group, Solar, Carbon Cloud, Pajama, do you say Pajama?
Pajama, Pajama. Yeah.
Okay. And Ecosia, I never really know how to pronounce that.
Ecosia, yeah.
Fantastic. Now you have built your first climate tech VC fund. What a journey. What has been your common nominator in these different roles and what is the biggest difference?
Yeah, great question. I mean, for one, I think one business always leads to the next one. I've seen that all over the years. So for example, I ran Acedo, the domain company, for over 10 years. And then towards the end of that journey, I discovered that a certain percentage of our advertising was basically eaten up by some obscure program. And that's how I discovered ad blocking in the first place. And so like usually one of my businesses led to the next one. But if you ask about a common denominator, I think for one, I've always been interested in digital products, in marketplaces, software. So a lot of the things, even in climate now, I do are software related because I'm a software guy at heart. That is the one common denominator. And then there's very often, there's also a mix of business model engineering, finance side on the one side, and then the tech on the other side. So that is, I would say, the second common denominator between, even if it doesn't look like that on the surface, but if you look beyond, that's the common denominator between those things.
So you're still a product guy at heart, kind of?
Product business model type at heart, yeah, definitely. So, I mean, I was a coder as a teenager. I coded for many, many years into my student years, but then I opted to study business. So for the business guys, I'm still the nerd, but for the real nerd, I'm the boring business guy. So it depends on the perspective.
I can very relate to this because I studied like a mixture between business administration and computer science and exactly the same.
Yeah.
When I work with my developers, they're like, yeah, that's the business, the product, the product person, you know, for the business people. So, oh, God, so geeky.
Exactly.
I know exactly what you mean. And what is kind of the biggest difference? Like if you look at the founder side and the investor side, what do you see as the biggest difference?
So as a founder, you really, and that's what I like about the founder side and also founding a fund, you're on the founding side again, because building up a fund with all the functions and learning a lot of new things is also founding something. The founder side, you control your own destiny. You employ people yourself. You make mistakes yourself. You do everything that is needed to make a company succeed. On the investor side, you only kind of scratch the surface, which is both good and bad. So on the investor side, what I really like about the investor side is you learn learn so much about new technologies. You speak with so many brilliant people who are experts in his or her domain. So it's very fulfilling as a learning experience. What I hate about it is that you can't do much about many things. As a VC, you're always minority investor. Yeah, you can coach the founder, but at the end, some listen, some don't, and you're at the mercy of the founder. That's why the team, of course, is the most important factor.
I feel you there. And I think that's exactly sometimes what I feel like being still like a founder. You can still do things. You can still control it. And on the investor side, you're more, you need to believe in them and just help them to do it. But it's very hard sometimes not to say, can you just not do it differently, please?
Yeah.
I totally get that. What were the really driving factors to change from that entrepreneurial track in the end into the investor track? You could have just stayed in the founding. You know, of course, you just said World Fund as well. It's like kind of a founding a new company because you found a new fund. But, you know, you've been investing before as a business angel before. What has been the driving factors to change from the pure serial entrepreneurial one to an investor track?
Yeah, it's been more of a, not a, this one decision. I started investing, doing business angel investments over 10 years ago. And I started doing angel investments a lot in this intersection of climate and software, Ecosia being one of the first ones. And then I built a lot of things around that. And so it's not been this kind of one thing. Because during this time, I've always also had entrepreneurial ventures. Ecosia, I was very hands-on. At IO, the company behind At, the biggest ad blocker in the world, I've been very, very hands-on. So kind of executive chairman role, SaaS group, I'm still very hands-on. So I've kind of liked both sides, but I've just done more and more investments over time. And with a fund, of course, I realized the same thing. What I realized with every startup as well is you need people who are better than yourself in that specific domain. So we teamed up here and have people like Daria coming from the prop tech and the VC side, people like Craig coming from the energy VC side, so very specifically on what we do, and of course a great team. But at the end of the day, it's them then doing a lot of the heavy lifting on the actual investment side. So I still kind of like both, and it's been more of a continuous journey for me doing that.
And you just said at the beginning, you know, it was kind of a natural thing to go from founder to the next role in the end to the investor role. Has there been a moment you remember when you started to go more and more being interested in the climate tech? Do you remember one moment where you thought like, okay, I really have to change and I really want to do more in that segment?
Not really. I wish I would be a better storyteller. but for that, we have our founding partner, Daniel. Honestly, there's not this one moment. I mean, I was brought up in Freiburg. It's my hometown. I was very, in a positive sense, influenced by ecological things very early on. We had solar on our roof in our 90s. I demonstrated against a new street, the B31 in Freiburg, even throwing mud balls as a teenager. I also demonstrated against the nuclear reactor just on the other side across the Rhine River.
What's your opinion now about it?
Well, that's a great question. Actually, that is the one thing where I probably think about differently these days. I wouldn't build new nuclear reactors, but the existing ones, I probably would have just kept them on because it is still the better choice than running coal. Now that the whole discussion, I mean, that would fill its own podcast, but it's been very, from both sides, very ideological. At the end, it doesn't matter. Like in Germany, it's like, what, 3% of the energy was, the discussion was much better than the actual relevance. I do think a bit differently about this now. I still do think about the street that we need to reduce traffic and every new street just brings new traffic. But long story short, I mean, that was kind of more my upbringing, and it was always been something I deeply cared about. And so it wasn't this one story which like suddenly opened my eyes and is like, oh shit, I need to change.
So we are kind of a climate activist already by heart, and in the end developed a business out of it.
Yeah, probably. I mean, if I would be young now, I would be a Klimakleber now. It sounds like the right thing to do and sounds fun, although it has collateral effects, but I very much sympathize with the urge to do something if people aren't listened to, as much as the means sometimes could be smarter, but I very much sympathize with that.
I really liked the quote you gave me in the pre-questionary. Like, you gave me this amazing quote: advertising has us chasing cars and clothes, working jobs we hate so we can buy shit we don't need. That's from Fight Club. Does that summarize the switch to climate tech?
To a certain extent, yes, because my first switch was really from Cedo, which was a domain name and on an advertising platform, still exists. It's a good company, world's largest domain trading platform, but it also was quite big in advertising. Then switching to the ad blocking side, where I think I realized more and more that advertising is actually at the heart of the problem. Because yeah, as this code rightly says, it like basically a lot of people just chase stuff which we really don't need. And that's a kind of a systematic problem. And at the end, it leads to overconsumption, over traveling, over everything. And I still think is the heart of it, which is why kind of in retrospect, the AdBlock company was also, I mean, I wouldn't go as far as calling it climate tech, but it went into the same direction. It was reducing something which was just wasteful spending. And actually, programmatic advertising is super wasteful. If you go on a website today, then within milliseconds, you have 100 different advertisers battling, get precisely you. They try to guess, you know, are you male, female? What age are you? What might be your interest and all of that in milliseconds? And of course, that uses a lot of server capacity just to serve you this one ad to try to get you to buy something. And the process itself is quite wasteful. So cutting this advertising at the source, at the client level, not even have this battle of all the ad servers, that is already quite a big thing. So I think I've been going into this direction now for over 15 years. But now, of course, with the World Fund, I want to do it with more, with things that have even more impact in energy.
Quite interesting what you're saying there. I just watched Social Dilemma on Netflix. Have you watched that?
Yeah, I did.
It just makes you so aware how easily we can be influenced.
Yes.
And that we are not aware. And it's a lot of subconsciousness, and that actually the entrepreneurs, and especially also the digital entrepreneurs, it's also their time to take responsibilities in what they're promoting and what how they actually bring us to buy more what we maybe don't need. I like that point. Coming from that, actually, from that digital entrepreneur side to Ecosia. So that's a search engine who plants a tree every time you place a search. That's correct, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So this tree planting practice has been quite criticized in media, like, you know, it's promising too much, but it cannot be delivered. How do you see that at Ecosia? And maybe just to get a step back, like, where do you stand right now at Ecosia? How many trees have you been planted? Where are they planted? Where are you standing at Ecosia? Just to give a little bit of background.
Sure. Yeah. So Ecosia, I've been helping to grow for over 10 years now. I didn't invent the idea and found it, but came on board very early on. And Ecosia is, yeah, as you said, a search engine, works just like Google. And then we use the advertising money and plant trees. At the beginning, it was a normal angel investment. But then 4 years ago, we turned it into a nonprofit as part of the Purpose Foundation. So the company can never be sold. We can never take out dividends. So essentially, it's a nonprofit. Now, it has reached a decent size. So we make about 40 million in revenue these days. And then, of course, we have our costs, server costs, personnel costs, marketing costs. But then we take a good chunk of that money and put it into tree planting. And so Ecosia has, over the years, become, thanks to our many, many users, one of the largest tree planters of native, or if not the largest tree planter of native trees in the world. With that, I mean, we don't plant agro-industry forests to then later cut it down, but actual native trees together with a local population, biodiverse in a very positive way. And to me, it's the simplest thing any person can do to help combat climate change. A lot of the changes in our personal lives we need to do, they require sacrifices. Flying less, eating less meat, heating less, and so on and so forth. Ecosia to me is super simple. You install it, search with it through Google, like you search to Google, and then we use that money to plant trees. And it's actually quite significant. So the equivalent in CO2 offsetting, you can offset a decent percentage of your carbon footprint. You're talking 10 to 30% depending on your footprint and your search profile. So it's actually a meaningful chunk. To me, it's a no-brainer on why not using it. And we're also growing, but I think, you know, everybody should be using it. And as I said, it's a nonprofit, so we don't take any money out at the end of the day. It's really our thing to have something where people can do easy for the climate for free. Now, why have we selected trees? Back to your main question. Trees are very, very powerful. They are, to us, and yes, there were some debates around it, but to us, they are still the most powerful thing to, in a short term, capture carbon while doing something also for the local microclimate, for biodiversity, for regenerative agriculture, or it has many social aspects as well. We have villages of thousands of people in Africa who rely on the money we send, but in a good way. They have nurseries, tree nurseries, then they plant them, so they harvest fruit. So it's a very, very holistic system we hear. And that's also, to answer your main question, this is the main thing which I think distinguishes us from others. Yes, there has been criticism on trees, but as everything, you can do things well or you can do things crappy. We have quite a good expertise in tree planting on how we do that, and that way I think we think it has a real long-term change, not just for the climate but also for many, many other things if done well. And then I think tree planting is very, very powerful, and much more powerful also as a, at least short-term, and with short-term I mean like 100-year carbon capture. And this is what we need right now. Like we don't need to think about centuries if the planet will be burning in the next 50 years. Then trees are just fine. And the way how trees can absorb carbon in their growth phase, of course, trees die at some point, but in the growth phase, the absorption is much cheaper, much better, much more effective as a quote unquote technology than big machines that suck carbon out of the air and try to then put them into stones. That is an admirable technology, but it just won't scale fast enough to do something.
And as well, what I understand is that Ecosia is not using that for carbon credits. You just Correct. Take the money and you plant trees. So it's not that you have to, like, if, because I think it's like 30% die roundabout, like trees, which is a normal process. In if you plant trees, 30-40% are dying, and whatever size, sometimes small, sometimes large. But you don't actually have to measure that because you don't sell the carbon credits to anyone.
Correct. Correct? We don't sell carbon credits. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's also the big difference to classic, and that has been the ones criticizing classic carbon credits generating forests. To how much is actually still there in 50 years if you sell carbon futures. That's super interesting. And the second part with the nature-based solutions you just addressed, I think it's a number, I think it's 67% of the carbon removal in the next 50 years needs to come from nature-based. And I think then it switches roundabout. I'm not 100% sure yet anymore. But I agree. And I think that's actually a very good going over to the other part what you're doing, which is the venture capital world, the World Fund. And one of the sectors we just discussed is nature-based solutions. But maybe you can just give a quick background about who is World Fund, how big it is, what kind of sectors you're investing in, what kind of focus you have.
Yeah, so World Fund is a 350 million European climate VC. It was started 1.5 years ago, actually by now hundreds of investors, some big names like European Investment Fund and other pension funds. But also, and for that, we're very proud, a lot of like excellent tech and climate tech entrepreneurs, mostly from Europe, with a lot of entrepreneurial background. And with that, we invest that money into the climate unicorns of tomorrow. So companies that really help in decarbonization, the decarbonization of our world, that can be in organic topics. So food, agriculture, land use, those are all organics, forestry, tree planting, regenerative agriculture, new ways of food. But also, of course, a big chunk is in energy and related fields. That is the whole decarbonization of our energy grid, but then also all the new uses from transportation, electrification of transportation and other means of decarbonizing transportation to housing, prop tech, the way we build things, to the way how we heat, light, everything, all the way down to things like material science and the production of things. So it's on the one side, it's a broad field. On the other side, we have a very narrow view on things of carbon being the common denominator here, and that the winner of the next decade or the next 20 years will be the ones that significantly reduce carbon, because that's what decarbonization means. And so the hypothesis is that we'll be the winners of that new wave and that transformation of our lives from a carbon economy to a decarbonized economy. That's basically the main hypothesis of the fund. Maybe last thing, we are a for-profit fund. We actually think, in this case, the impact, so the CO2 savings, they they're very much aligned with the financial success. If a company does well, then they will also save a lot of carbon. If they don't do well, then they will have neither a financial nor a carbon return. And so the two things are really not mutually exclusive, but we feel that they're super aligned.
Now you mentioned a lot of like different sectors, so material science, energy, farming. How do you make sure that you have actually the expertise in investing in these very broad different sectors and really figuring out, is that the one, what you said, climate unicorn in the future?
Yeah, so it's a series of things on how we address the variety of topics. One is that within our team, we have chemists, we have nuclear physicists, we have mechanical engineers, we have chemists and so on and so forth. So we have a broad variety in the team. But then, of course, the topics themselves are quite special. So we work very closely together with a lot of academic institutions, then getting the input from them also for our climate performance potential. We work also very closely together with specialized funds. So, for example, there are very specialized funds on alternative proteins, companies that only do that. Then usually we are the carbon specialists, also have a lot of advantages there, but they might have an even deeper sector expertise, but are usually smaller, so we can finance longer. So very often we have good partnerships there. We also have this LP base, which is great. Some of our LPs have founded some of the biggest climate companies in Europe, and they usually have a very deep sector expertise. For example, here, neighbors in Cologne for me are the founders of Nextkraftwerke. They know a lot about the energy grid and virtual power plants and that side of things, which is a crucial role. And they've been doing this for 15 years. So unlike many people who've just started with this. So we very much rely on also our network there for both deal inflow, but also for expertise on judging the quality of technologies and startups.
From your point of view, what has been the craziest investment you've done where you think like, oh my God, that's really shooting to the moon. But, you know, if it works, it's amazing.
Well, shooting to the moon, I think, is the right word here, is actually an investment in a company called SpaceForge. They do in-space manufacturing. First time when my partner Daria brought this deal, I was like, where's the climate tech here? And then she explained, and that, of course, is also the right approach, is that you can manufacture semiconductors in space in a way that later they are 5 to 10 times more energy efficient because of a sort of diamond coating. And not an expert in this. I'm not a manufacturing expert at all. But the analysis which we did was very clear that little factory, which is not much bigger than a small box, shooting that one with some other rocket into space and then safely returning in that part, the carbon footprint of that is actually very small compared to then the thousands of semiconductors which are in one charge, which later get to deploy in 5G and servers and other things and can serve massive amounts of energy if done right. So that is probably our craziest investment in the World Fund.
And is it already working?
The manufacturing is working. They also already had their first test runs, and one of their core technologies they're working on is getting everything safely returned to Earth. That is, is actually the hardest thing. But I think that will be ready for production fairly soon.
Oh, amazing. I read somewhere that you would like to save 2 gigatons of CO2 by 2040. Is that correct? So just to put it into perspective, I think right now we are blowing up into the sky 50 gigatons of CO2 equivalents. So like, you know, also nitrogen and all the other stuff. I think it's 37 pure CO2. Mm-hmm. So that's still quite a big amount if you want to take 2 gigatons of CO2 out of it, just, you know, the World Fund. And you would like to, you know, every startup needs to deliver at least 100 million CO2 savings, which is actually pretty hard and pretty tough to get that done. So you will probably, like, it's just a very easy calculation. You probably need to have at least 20 startups up and running and successfully delivering to that goal till 2040. How do you realistically see that these startups do exist in Europe in the next 20 years?
Well, they better exist because we blow that amount you just mentioned into the air. So 2 gigatons is not even that much. 2040 is a long time. By then, a lot of those technologies need to be mature. Of course, we hope that those will be our startups. But for us, of course, the carbon potential is almost more of a way to look at the like the total addressable market. Classic venture capital thing is like, how big can this market get? And our idea is to see if something moves the needle. Of course, we hope that those are our startups, but we pretty much hope that even if it's not our startup, in every single of the fields we invest, there'll be one market leader at the end who does drive the transformation in that way. And I think there will be at least 20, well, there will be a lot more in Europe. I think Europe has a lot of the ingredients. We have a lot of climate, like we have 1/3 of the climate patents in the world. We have over 1/3 of the engineering and other disciplines needed of students. We also have more startups started in that field, but then we just don't have enough capital. That is the problem of Europe, that we don't scale enough. So that's exactly kind of what our approach is on why we want to change this. But I pretty much hope, I mean, there will be more than 20 companies coming out from Europe. But, and that's important, with technology that is globally applicable. We can't save our world alone if we just tackle Europe. But the idea is, of course, that we have technologies which are better. And those technologies then proliferate across the entire world. Equally, of course, we'll have great technologies coming out of Asia and the US, which will then proliferate in the other parts of the world. But that we have superior technology, which in the end will make a difference. And that's the good thing with carbon. Very often technologies are really superior in terms of efficient, more cost-effective, that reducing waste, that it very often makes a lot of economic sense, which is why I'm actually an optimist we talked about nuclear earlier today. Nuclear was a superior technology maybe 20, 30 years ago, but today the mix of solar, wind, and some smart storage plus software can yield to much lower prices than nuclear. And so I think we see a lot more technologies like that already coming out now, but also coming out in the next 10 years.
You just mentioned the financial gap, not only in Europe, I think it's worldwide. I think we're still facing a $3 trillion financial gap per year to really finance the climate transition, which is like a crazy amount of money. How do you see that, you know, VCs cannot purely be, you know, the ones driving that? How do you see the role of VCs versus the other asset classes, and what needs to be changed? What needs to change that actually we can get that financial gap like closer?
Yeah, VCs can't finance all of that. VCs are for an early stage when there is still not a full product market fit. And for scaling things, then, as you see today, once technology reaches maturity, like you see in solar, for example, you see in wind, then there is much more money available. Then, of course, others have to chime in. And they're doing that because then a technology has been de-risked, but especially in that early risk phase, VCs will always play a role. I mean, they have every new transformation, they play a role, like they played a role in the rollout of the internet. And I think here it'll be the same thing. Just like what digitalization was in the last 20 years, is decarbonization in the next 20 years.
So funny. That was my title of my keynote from yesterday.
Oh, really? Wow, cool.
Yeah, exactly. So funny. Yeah, I said like green retail because I had a keynote about green retail.
Good.
And I said green retail is exactly like the digital revolution 20 years ago. And I actually showed how it's developing. Exactly. Very funny.
I'd love to see your slides. I didn't see the presentation. Sounds like great minds think alike, but I'd love to see that presentation if it's somewhere online. Or
yeah, I will. I can send it to you as well. And I totally agree. And I think that's kind of the mindset we need to have. And one of the things when we started 20 years ago, the digital revolution, everyone said like, no one is going to buy shoes and furniture online.
Online, yeah.
And now we're standing right now. In Switzerland, it's not as high as yet as in other countries, but I think there is the problem. What I see is that we're just too slow because, you know, the digital revolution, if you buy it in offline or online, that doesn't really change something in the world, for the world, for the earth. But here we are in a more hurry to actually get that. Do you see any policies we need to change to actually, you know, accelerate that transition? Or do you see any other drivers in the market to get that transition quicker?
Well, to me, the CO2 price is probably the single biggest measure, is making sure that polluting the environment, the climate, isn't free anymore. Currently, it mostly is. Sure, I mean, we have in some sectors, like the energy sector, we have a European cap and trade system in Switzerland. You mentioned that we also have a carpet price of already 120 francs. The problem is very often it's just on a very small segment. It needs to be on everything and it needs to be high enough. And then I think there'll be also great entrepreneurs making sure that you find ways to reduce it. But of course, if it's free, the economy will always say, sure, what's free, I'll use to the maximum. That's capitalism. But fortunately, we have ways to curb that. And that's a CO2 price.
Do you see that coming, like going up over... I think you said mentioned like 200, 300. Do you see that coming?
I see that coming. Of course, you know, I'm not sure here if there I'm just an optimist because I really think we need it. There's always political opponents to it, but I have good hopes that it will be coming.
Yeah. Yeah. There is also, I really hope, I also agree with that, will be one of the key drivers of change. If it hurts on the balance sheet, it's going to move.
Yeah, then it's going
to
move.
Coming back a little bit to the venture capital side, there has been also a lot of discussion about, is the VC model broken, especially, you know, for the climate tech sectors, which is usually having way longer development times and go to market and to really reach the return on investment kind of typical VC KPIs. It usually takes maybe longer than 10 years or 12 years if you extend it. How do you see that?
Yeah, the VC model has some downsides there. In the beginning, when we started World Fund, we debated quite a bit, should we be an evergreen, so a company that has no end lifetime, or should we be a 20-year fund like Breakthrough Energy? At the end, we decided that the investing in climate is crazy enough for the financial world, which tends to be quite conservative. And so we opted for a very classic model, knowing that it's imperfect. I think you have a point there, but also after some time, you can always do secondaries. You can sell the company, even if it's not ready, to some fund, which is a bit later stage. So it doesn't mean that it's the end of that company if your fund runs out. And also, let's face it, a lot of the funds, also in internet terms of VCs that have a 10-year lifetime, that 20 years in, they still hold some of the holdings. And it's like, well, that's just the way it is.
Understood. So, you know, you came from the digital entrepreneur side. And I think a lot of whom I'm discussing at the moment have been digital entrepreneurs before, software as a service founders, etc., who are actually considering now to go more into the climate tech space. And, you know, we just discussed the space, which is really, I would say, deep tech and hard tech. Coming from the software side, what would you recommend these digital entrepreneurs if they want to move into the climate tech space and are a little bit like lost, where do I start, what shall I do? What do you recommend them?
I always recommend, for people who don't know where to start, Project Drawdown, the book. There's a website, Project Drawdown, just Ecosia it. Project Drawdown, with a lot of projects by an international community of scientists, which basically have clustered the entire world in projects that need to be done to decarbonize. And that's... it's a really good starting point. There's also a physical book, which is nice to read, the top 100 projects, and to just get an idea what are the areas to tackle. That book, actually, when Christian, the founder of Ecosia, gave it to me many years ago, it was one of the starting points to think about the World Fund, because there's so many great things and they all need entrepreneurs. And actually, I'm very thankful for many of the entrepreneurs who now go into this space, because they know how to build companies, they know how to scale. And so we need young entrepreneurs, but we also need successful entrepreneurs who know how to scale to get into this world and make it better.
So if you would look now as an investor perspective on the future, and that's maybe as well for the digital entrepreneurs quite interesting, what are the biggest bets for the future in the next 5 years? Where do you think in the climate tech sector? You mentioned a lot of different ones, but if you have to pick three, what would be the pick?
So I think one would be in food. I think our reliance on beef, and then beef or meat in general, but beef is, of course, the worst offender, is achieved by massive deforestation in wide parts of the world. We're always thinking Latin America, but same if you look at the percentage of the land in the United States that is actually used to grow soy and wheat and other things to feed livestock, it's like 30% or something. So it's like so huge. And if we would have trees on that, it would like solve many of our problems. And that is kind of across the world. So I think the animals and animal proteins and meat is one big bet. The other one is in the energy network, where I would say that I would bet on storage, because producing energy is dirt cheap these days with solar and wind. It just tends to come at the wrong time or has a problem. If we would solve storage, I think energy would be solved. And contrary to other things like fusion, fission, and so on, I think we're closer there. So I think there's a real possibility to do this. And the last thing would be intelligence in the energy grids. Basically, at the moment, our energy grids are so stupid. Like, there's no connection between supply and demand. It's a super dumb system. If we would solve that, that would also solve a lot of the storage problems. Part of the storage is standing in our garage more and more. So solving all of this intelligence, and it's a lot about software, AI, things, that would be the third one I would bet on.
That's kind of the virtualized
The virtualized grids. Power plants, yeah.
Yeah. A friend of mine is actually having a startup in US called Leap, which is exactly doing that, what you just described. What I see there, and it's coming back to the policies and to the structure, what we have in Europe in place, it's extremely difficult because it's such a, you know, regulated, centralized, you know, in Switzerland, everything needs to go back to the network and then they distribute it again and stuff like that. But very interesting 3 points. I really like that. So what does sustainability actually mean for you personally?
So I try to make it part of everyday life. So, I mean, one is I really, really, because that's the biggest lever, I think, for most of us in a kind of globalized business world, is cutting back on flying. I try to fly very little, maybe 2 or 3 times in Europe per year maximum. Of course, anything below 7-8 hours I would do by train. Transatlantic, I basically try to not do it. I've now done one transatlantic flight in 7 years, really, but then it had to be worth it and it was a trip of many months. So I try to be really, really conscious on that, because to me, that's the biggest lever, because the flight is just so quick and every hour of flying is 0.25 tons, 250 kilograms of CO2. So basically a 4-hour flight is like sets you back 1 ton. And that's quite crazy. That is probably my biggest lever. A lot of the other things I would say are fairly simple and everybody should do is changing your energy provider to a green energy provider, putting solar on your roof. All of those are no-brainers and even profitable. Putting solar on your roof is a very profitable investment. Cutting back on meat. I'm not fully vegetarian, but I've cut back on a lot of meat, but that I find definitely harder to completely do it. But for both health and other reasons, it's something I think which is good anyway. And then last but not least is really the dedicating my time to it. That's the most valuable thing I can do as an entrepreneur and investor is dedicating my time and my money. I've also invested the majority of my personal liquidity into our fund because I believe not just that it's the right thing to do, but I believe that's actually, as an investor, you can profit from the change. Whenever there is a change where things are fundamentally moving into one direction, then there's always also means an opportunity. And so I think that's what I'm trying to do.
Nice. I like especially the last point, because I think from a consumer perspective, I think many will struggle to exactly what you described, the cutting and, you know, convenience. We're such a, as you said, we're convenience driven. Is it cheap, convenient, easy? Yeah. I think that's kind of the basic of humanity, unfortunately. But yeah. I think especially the entrepreneur part, and that's what I'm trying as well to push a lot, that the ones who are in charge, the CEOs, the entrepreneurs, they need to think about how do they deliver products in a more sustainable way and better products, more sustainable products through their consumers. And really start blaming the consumers, they're wasting everything, instead of like not doing themselves the reduction and thinking about what we actually deliver. But I really like your points on that. So coming to the end of the podcast, and I think, you know, I had so many more questions I could probably ask you. Maybe we have to do a second one. I really enjoyed that conversation. Is it possible actually as a private person to invest into Wellfund? If someone like comes now and say like, hey, I really would like to invest into Wellfund, would that be possible?
We have the same limit as every regulated closed fund, Germany under BaFin regulations, which is that investments are only possible for knowledgeable investors, meaning people who have prior experience in this field with a minimum of 200,000 euros. That is the German regulation, we're a German fund. So if that applies, then yes, but there is no way of buying it on the stock exchange, for example, or buying it with a smaller amount. Unfortunately not. the regulatory environment for VC funds.
So it's a professional for professional investors.
Yes. And we have a lot of private people, but most of them are, we have people, yeah, who are entrepreneurs. We have people who are also professionals like attorneys, consultants, and made money there. We have people who are managers of some DAX companies. So we have a lot of like high profile professional ones, but they then tend to do this as part of their general capital allocation. So it's, there are very high restrictions to invest in VC because let's face it, it's a risky asset. It delivers, of course, above average result on average, but also it's illiquid, it's risky. And I think that's the protection put in place there for better or worse.
Fantastic. And I think in the end, people can still, you know, use Ecosia.
Yes,
I think so, that's
if I have one call to action, then please use Ecosia.
Exactly. Fantastic. How can people reach out to you if they want to know more, you know, about Euro and World Fund, etc.?
Email is always, I'm an email guy, tim@worldfund.vc is my email. LinkedIn, also possible. I do quite a bit on LinkedIn, kind of my only social network. Twitter used to be also in the mix, but it's, I've kind of written this off for now. So it's pretty much the only social network I actually use.
Fantastic. So thank you so much for joining my podcast, Tim. It was really a pleasure to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining today's episode. You can find the show notes, background materials, and contact details of our guests on our website, sustainnow.ch. Follow and share our podcast on any platform available. Do you have a comment or interesting solution to take a deep dive? Please don't hesitate to go to our website, sustainnow.ch, and write us an email.